you guys. I'm K2 Romeo India Whiskey. At this time, we begin the TechNet like we've done for the last 34 years, 35 years, something like that. September of 1982 is when it began. This will be TechNet number 1695. You'll also be hearing from Roy, AC2GS, with his science and physics and astronomy report. You'll be hearing from Paul, WS2N, with the space report, which also includes a good deal of astronomy. You'll be hearing space report number 295, science, physics, and space report number 25. And I noticed that we get an awful lot of positive feedback whenever we get into pretty nice discussions of astronomy, astrophysics. Let me drop. As I've so often said, I think inside of each true radio amateur, with his curiosity, is a desire to be a scientist. We study the way antennas and all of our hardware works and the way the signal propagates through space. Well, we're also interested in radio astronomy and that universe out there. My goodness, there's a zillion different ways of interpreting it, and our interpretation keeps continuously changing. It's extremely complicated. Where did all that stuff come from? How did it get here? How did we get here? Are we alone? Tomorrow at something like 6:26 at night, the TESS satellite is going to be launched, Transiting Exoplanet Satellite Survey. And this particular add-on to the Kepler Space Telescope is going to be looking for exoplanets, looking for planets going around stars. Let me drop. And Paul will be giving you a lot more information about that launch and what it intends to do. But it's going to be looking at, I've seen two different reports. One report says 200,000, the other says 500,000 stars are going to be looked at simultaneously. Looking for that dip in light when a planet passes in front of that star, as observed by TESS. TESS is the third satellite in that series of Hubble, Spitzer, Kepler, and TESS is the fourth of the series, and eventually there'll be the James Webb Space Telescope. So the fourth satellite, at least one of their functions is to look for exoplanets, planets going around nearby stars. Just to give you one example of where there's been a huge change in astronomy. Let me think. Let me drop. When the Drake equation was written, I think in the late 60s, 70s, somewhere around there, when he tries to predict how many stars have got planets and how many of them are going to have life, Mr. Drake used to think that one star per million would have planets, somewhat like our planets going around our star, the Sun. He used to think one in a million. By way of the latest findings of Kepler, we know that essentially every single star has planets, and most of them have multiple planets, so our assessment of how much life is up there has just gone up by a million to one. And now as we start finding out how many of those planets are Earth-like, TESS is going to be looking specifically for the nearby Earth-like planets. We've already found something like 3,000 planets. Not too many of them are Earth-like. Many of them are very much larger. But TESS is going to be looking more for the close-by Earth-like planets. So some exciting astronomy is going to be taking place, as you can tell. Let me drop. The first section of the TechNet is people signing in because they do have a question or a comment about any of the subjects, quite often usually ham radio. Why does my rig do this? What piece of transmission line should I use? What's my favorite antenna for my particular apartment? The 26 different kinds of ham radio, there's all kinds of questions about that. So we take people checking in, giving us their call letters, their name, and the word yes, which means do have a question or a comment for the net. So we take those in order. That's around the first hour or so, depending on how many questions and how much enthusiasm. That's followed by Roy, AC2GS, and Dr. Roy will be giving us another science, physics, space report of his particular kind. And I might try to squeeze in my bicycle pump puzzle that I've been threatening for the last few weeks. When it comes to the subject of temperature, material has been brought to our attention in the classes we've taken. So we're innocent on misinterpretations of temperature and kinetic energy of molecules and what a phenomenon measures. Let me drop. So Roy AC2GS will be the second section with a whole lot of kibitzing by me, and then Paul WS2N with the space report and many more of the details of TESS satellites to be launched tomorrow at around 6:30 p.m. Okay, time for you guys to check in. You're going to give me your call letters and your name. But by the word yes, meaning you do have a question or a comment, please try to wait for the four beeps in between each transmission so we don't time out. K2IW listening for check-in.
M2EO, take a have a short announcement, if okay.
Okay, Rich recognized. Anyone else to check in? Well, while we're waiting for other people to arrive and decide they want to check in, give us your short announcement, Rich. N2EO, K2IW.
Okay, Dick, N2EO. Yes, I found out about a phone number for the controller's office of New York State. Jeremy, that's Patty's son. He found out about it, and he used it. But Jeremy had about $150 back, lost funds. In my case, I had quite a bit of money that my father left me and went into lost funds. You have to call a number, 800-221-9311. It'll take about a half hour to open. We're open from 8 a.m. to 5 p.m. Monday through Friday. You'll have to get in queue, and when somebody picks up, give me a name and wait in your address, and they'll look. If there's any money there, they'll give you a claim number. And if it was somebody that passed away, in my case, my dad, they want a photocopy of his death certificate. I have to mail that with a claim number, and for me, there's quite a bit of money. Take back to you, N2EO.
Yeah, very, very fine, Rich. That is interesting information. And for us, almost all of us have had someone in their family who died. In some cases, I guess there's funds left over that hasn't been properly claimed. And if we amateurs can claim those funds, in theory, we can go out and buy some more hemorrhoids. That's a little bit of a joke, but you know what I mean. Okay. 800-221-9311. Between 8 and 5 p.m. on the Monday through Friday. I think it's a New York State Comptroller's Office. And they keep track of funds that we're owned, that we're owed. And that could be good. In fact, even I should be checking on that one. Anybody have any further questions or comments on this? Any fields? K2IW, are you listening?
Yeah, KD2HUC with a comment.
Mr. HUC, go right ahead. I think it's Steve, isn't it?
Yeah, Dick, the thing that Rich is talking about, it's not just, you know, funds that have been left to you. It's any refunds, anything. I usually go to the website once a year, and a couple of times there was a little surprise money waiting for me. You could go to the phone number, but if you go to their website, you can do it around the clock. You put in your name, your address, and they'll tell you right away if anything's owed to you, and you can click a button to you know, execute a claim. Check shows up at the house about 2 weeks later. It really is that easy. So go to the website. It's just as fast, if not faster, than the phone call. KD2HUC, back to net.
Steve, you gave us a very extractive-sounding piece of information, but you left out one very important piece of information. You said go to the website. Give us a clue about how you find the website. Over to you, Steve.
Just Google the New York State Controller's Office, and it will come up. The gentleman's name is Tom DiNapoli, and, you know, you can't miss it. His picture's right on the page with his name and all, and it says something along the lines of, you know, search lost funds, or it's very, very intuitive. It's very simple. You go right to the website, you know, you Google it, you go to the website, and it's very straightforward.
Unclaimed funds.
Unclaimed funds. On the New York State Comptroller's Office. Tom DiNapoli. So, any of these combinations, we'll probably find it. Rich has got some further info for us. N2EO, K2RIW, Grand Rich.
Stick. Originally, I got on the internet. I almost got scammed. I did not. I called, it said, this one said unclaimed money. Don't go to that. Unclaimed funds. And whoever came in there is quite right. This other one asked me for $34.95 to get the unclaimed funds. So I didn't say, I said some pretty nasty things and hung up. Yes, he's talking. This fellow came in there just now. He's correct.
Anybody have any further information, fills, questions, or whatever on this subject? Give me a call at us right now. K2RIW and the Tech Man.
Dick, I do have the website for you if you want. It's KD2HEC.
Couldn't hurt. Let it fly, Steve. Go ahead.
Okay, it's OSC, as in Office State Controller, .state, .New York, or NY, rather, .US.
Okay, I'm guessing that's there for it's www. Dot, and maybe not www, but anyhow, OSC, Oscar Sierra Charlie, .state, S-T-A-T-E, .NY, .US. Is that a Roger D. Red?
Yep, that's correct. I do not see a www in front of it.
So it's one of these things where you just start typing in the OSC. Okay, good information. Anyone else to check in? Because you do have a question or a comment for the TechNet, please give me your call letters and your name right now. K2RIW and the TechNet, we're listening.
W-H-Y-Y, Joe, yes, from last week.
Joe recognized. Anyone else? Please give me your call letters and name right now.
KD2PKA. No.
Okay, Jay with a no. Anyone else with a yes? One last call. Anybody with any questions or comments on any subject in the world, so to speak, of interest to radio amateurs? Other than Raquel Welch's the phone number, I'm dating myself. Give me your call letters right now, K2RIW.
Hey, you know what, Dick? Put me down. KD2HUC. Yes.
Okay, we got you, Steve. Okay, let's start off with Joe. KD2LYY. How those electrons and photons treating you today, Steve? I mean, Joe. KD2LYY. K2RIW.
Very good, Dick. Well, give me a choice. I don't know. You like answering both types of questions, either a radar question or an antenna question. Take your pick.
Whichever one do you think that'll be most illuminating for this particular group? You do the choosing, Joe.
Okay. Like I always use the next. Take the next question that doesn't get answered and put it in another week. That's okay. Let's go to the radar one, okay? Because this is, I've been kind of curious about this one for a little while. If you have a situation where you have, say, a bunch of naval ships operating out on maneuvers, and they're all running their radar at the same time, looking for, you know, stuff over the horizon or something like that, as they typically do, what prevents the radar transmitter from one ship from interfering with the echo that's supposed to be received from another ship? Because don't they operate all these things on the same frequency band? Back to you.
Same frequency band, but almost never on the exact same frequency, Joe. They may be operating in the 1100 to 1200 megahertz region. Well, that's 100 megacycle wide. The actual radar signal itself is, the IF strip is probably 1 megacycle wide, and if you look at the spectrum on a spectrum analyzer, which looks like a, what they call a sine X over X, it's a big bump in the middle and smaller bumps off to the side. It looks like an antenna pattern with side lobes. That's the frequency spectrum you see on a spectrum analyzer, where horizontal axis is frequency and vertical axis is power. So almost all radars are on a slightly different frequency intentionally. But even in the case when they are on the exact same frequency, if there's a reasonable distance between the two, like a mile or 10 miles or 30 miles, because the antenna usually has a beam width in the vicinity of 1, 2, or 3 degrees of beam width, and the antenna frequently is rotating at something like a 1 revolution per 12 seconds is a typical rotation rate for a surveillance radar. Let me drop. It's obvious that if you've got a 3-degree beam width and your antenna is rotating, only 1% of the time is my antenna aimed at your ship out there. His antenna is also rotating. Only 1% of the time is his antenna aimed in my direction. So, with the normal rules of probability, very rarely are the two antennas aimed at each other or co-aligned. If the ship, the other ship happens to be exactly north of you, and during the time that your antenna is aimed north and his antenna is aimed north, yes, you are both looking at the same series of targets. But even there, there'll be a lack of correlation because he has a certain pulse duration, a certain pulse repetition rate. You have a certain pulse repetition rate. And the chances of that all coming out together, being just a co-aligned, if you know what I mean, are pretty slim. So the chances of his target showing up on your radar screen and sitting there steady from scan to scan is very unusual. Let me drop. Now, when you look at your spectrum analyzer and you see that the characteristic pattern of a pulsed radio signal, it's called sine X over X. It's a mathematical function. That's the outer envelope. And that outer envelope is filled up with a whole bunch of individual lines. If your radar is running at 300 pulses per second, then every 300 hertz there is a line. So there's thousands of lines on that screen inside of that envelope of sine X over X. Your spectrum analyzer, you normally set it so that it'll see signals that are down 50, 60, 70 dB from the peak envelope power. However, that sine X over X really goes out very far. If you're willing to look 100 or 200 or 300 megahertz away, there is some energy there. As such, let me drop. When two ships' radars are in the same vicinity, they're both in the same harbor, or they're both in the same Long Island Sound, we'll say, or they're both on the same island like Long Island. One of them might be at Montauk Point, and one of them might be at Kennedy Airport. When you get two radars in the same band operating simultaneously, you will see a number of mysterious dots appearing on the screen. The radar operators call it fruit. I get some extra fruit on my screen because of that other radar. The fruit has a very characteristic view, or very characteristic picture it creates. From scan to scan, those individual dots do not align. A real target moves in some characteristic way so that when you look at the scan-to-scan persistence on the phosphor screen of the radar, you can see the motion of the airplane that you're scanning, or that you're tracking, or the boat that you're tracking. You see the motion. But from scan to scan, there's a strong correlation. The fruit you get from another radar, with rare exception, it does not correlate. It moves around in a funny way. It only fills up 1% of the screen, so to speak, and it fills up the screen in all kinds of crazy places. No real target will fill up the screen that way. So I trained radar operator, has very little difficulty telling the difference between the phony pulses coming from the other radar versus the real pulses that are being picked up, scanned, and recorded by your particular radar, looking at its targets. Let me drop. So it turns out that a radar operator has a significant advantage over us. If you and I are on the 80-meter band, and if we're within 3 kilohertz of each other, and we live only a mile apart, and we're both transmitting single sideband, I'm going to hear all kinds of garbling noise when you're talking at the same time I'm trying to listen. We amateurs have very high duty factor signals. In other words, Morse code is on the air 50% of the time, single sideband is on the air 80% of the time. Only when you stop talking does the single sideband signal go away. And if you're running one of the digital modes, you're really there almost continuously. So we have very high duty factor signals. So our signals, when they're on essentially the same frequency, in the same vicinity, if we're within 30 miles of each other, we're going to be getting some interference. And so, lucky for us, we've got very wide ham bands. We can QSY. In other words, we can shift our frequency somewhere else to get away from it. But if you've got to operate near the calling frequency during a contest, and a whole bunch of guys are doing the same thing, you're going to be giving each other some grief. Let me drop. But that radar transmits a pulse for 1, 2, 3 microseconds. Then there is something like 3,000 microseconds before another pulse is being transmitted. So you're on the air 0.1% of the time. It's a very low duty factor signal. It's a potent signal, but 99.9% of the time the signal is not there. So therefore the amount of fruit you get on that screen is a very small percentage of the screen being lit up with these extraneous pulses from the other radar. So the radar operators have a significant advantage over us when it comes to simultaneous operation on the same band, and we happen to be near the same frequency. A well-designed radar can retune its frequency they can QSY, if you know what I mean, and make the problem a hell of a lot less. But most of the time, they don't even bother. They don't have to. And some of the information I think you're looking for, Joe, to B2RYY, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Okay, thanks, Dick. Very good explanation. I have a little story for you. Which, you can put at the end of the series of questions of other people checking in. It's related to FM pirates using the FM broadcast band to broadcast. If you'd like to hear about that, how I got involved in that, related to that, I'll let you know at the end of the, you know, I can tell you about that at the end of the series of questions on the beginning of the net here.
Comment, and to wheel.
Go ahead with your comment, Rich.
Stick, I don't know anything about radar, but I can tell you something from history, because I study on the internet about World War II, FDR, and Truman, and all that stuff. Right at the beginning of the war, we started to have radar. That radar in Pearl Harbor. And I guess they didn't have friend or foe. You tell me, Dick, because they picked up, they were expecting a flight of B-17s from California. And they mistakenly, what they picked up was the attack. But they didn't realize it, right? Which. They never expected the attack. They thought it was the B-17s.
And that World War II Pearl Harbor radar incident had a real huge comedy of errors. The guys operating the radar were about to go off. Their shift was about to end. They were using the radar, I think, primarily at nighttime, and their shift was ending at 7 o'clock in the morning or something like that. It was a brand new installation where we hadn't yet developed very much faith in it. It was a VHF radar, had rather long range, and it showed a whole lot of targets, but they thought they've seen targets like that before from the friendlies. There was no IFF yet, as like you said. So it didn't get reported to the chain of command. And I think that occurred on a Sunday morning where most of the chain of command wasn't on duty, if you know what I mean. So a really terrible situation. Had we had more forewarning, it would have saved an awful lot of lives. And that radar could have given that forewarning. The simplest radar I've ever built when I was doing some work at Edwards Air Force Base now, and I wanted to find the extraneous echoes in their main chamber. Let me drop the mic. I simply put two X-band horns. A horn for X-band, the 10 gigahertz frequency region, is about 3 inches wide and 2 inches high. I'm talking about the open end of the horn. It's got a piece of WR90 waveguide going to it, 9/10 of an inch width waveguide on the back end of the horn. So I started off with a signal generator. I think it was a plus 20 dBm signal generator that put out a signal at 10 gigahertz. I think it was a, can't think of the brand name right now, of the frequency synthesizer. Put that into a pulsing network so that the pulses were coming out of that signal generator going into one of those horns. The two horns were mounted side by side on a yardstick. The other horn went into a spectrum analyzer that was being properly set. And so I'm transmitting out of one horn and listening out of the other horn, and I knew I was looking for echoes that were between 0 and 150 feet away, starting off with the center of that chamber that was 300 foot square. So to find echoes with a very simple setup like that was amazingly easy. So there's a lot of cases where we amateurs on the frequency bands where we're allowed to transmit pulses, where you'd be amazed how easy it would be to set up a very short range radar, where you'd get a kick out of seeing the echo from the trees and the tower in your backyard and stuff like that. So radar can be an awful lot of fun. And let me drop. Since I worked with Airborne Instruments Laboratory for 35 solid years, 35 and a half years, and since every single product they made had something to do with radar, my goodness, you listen to any conversation in any cubicle you pass, when they had the 2,000 engineers in that building, so to speak, and you walk down the hall and you listen to the conversations, you're almost always hearing something about radar. Radar, antennas, transmitters, receivers, pulse-forming networks, IF strips, proper alignment of the of all of the above, rotary joints, ATR circuits, and so on. It just goes on and on and on for years on end. A good radar, the antenna department says that a radar consists of an extremely good antenna with some electronics hanging on it. That's the antenna designer's point of view, because you're trying to design an antenna that gives you a good impedance match, broadband frequency response, 3 degrees, 2 degrees, 1 degree of beam width, very low front-to-back ratio, very high front-to-back ratio, very low side lobes. So a very good antenna is required for a good radar. Then you hang some electronics on it. But you talk to the other guys, and of course they got their point of view. Okay, we're going to go over to Steve, who's got a question for us. Probably got something to do with electronics, but it's not necessarily true. KD2HUC, K2RIW, good, Steve.
Hey, Dick. First off, I have a question for Eric. You know, after he put up that new antenna at Glen Oaks, the repeater by my house was crystal clear. And like the past few tech nets, I was even able to listen to it crystal clear on AELI omnidirectional antenna I have. I mean, it sounded beautiful. All of a sudden tonight, I find that it's hissing and crackling again. I actually had to go back to the directional in order to pick up the repeater. Did something change over there at Glen Oaks?
The only thing that's changed is weather.
Yeah, I'm looking at my single strength meter, and I'm getting the normal good single strength tonight, Steve. So, if you stood at your antenna location, on top of your tower, on top of your house, wherever it's located, and looked in the direction of the Glen Oaks repeater, when I'm standing on top of my 100-foot tower with a set of binoculars, I have no trouble seeing not only Eric's tower in Plainview, but also the Glen Oaks building and the antennas on top of it. So I've got line of sight. You probably are looking through a mile of trees before that signal sees line of sight. And the trees are starting to bloom, and therefore you're going to be seeing weaker signals, particularly on a rainy day. Wet trees on a rainy day, if you're looking through them, you'd be amazed how absorptive they are to VHF signals, Steve. That's a bunch of guesses on my part. So what's your guess as to a set of binoculars right at your antenna looking at Glen Oaks? What do you think they're going to see? KD2HUC, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Well, over by me, the trees haven't started blooming yet, so I don't see, like Eric said, anything other than the weather difference. But that's good to know. That means I probably need to go up onto the roof and visit the Omni and check the connector and make sure I'm not getting water infiltration. All right, very good. Let me let it drop.
And by the way, even without the leaves on the trees, the wet branches of the trees are absorptive if you're looking through a mile of those. Go ahead, Steve. Wait for the beeps.
All right. My question, Dick, is regarding the back end of amplifiers. I think I might have even sent you an email a while ago, but I kind of forgot about it. But my question is, I've been working on a solid-state amp, and I noticed that in all the solid-state designs, there's no back-end tuning, just a low-pass filter. Yet two systems all require a tuner, a Pi network of some sort. Why is that? What is different about the solid-state that doesn't require tuning that where the vacuum tubes do? KD2HUC, back to net.
All broadband design.
Yeah, some amplifiers are trying to cover an octave in frequency, and therefore you can't tolerate any tuning. And that amplifier that covers an octave that has no tuning, if you look at it with a spectrum analyzer, you'll probably find the second harmonic is only 20 dB weaker than the fundamental. Quite often that happens. So therefore, the amplifier designer, because he's trying to make particular bandwidth, he doesn't feel compelled to do anything to specifically suppress his second harmonic, unless he happens to be using the right kind of hybrid, and he's getting the power by combining two stages. Quadrature hybrid, combining two stages in the final, does a fair amount of rejection of the second harmonic. From his point of view, the customer who bought his amplifier, that customer has to put in a separate filter if he cannot tolerate that second harmonic that's coming out of that amplifier. I bet you Eric's got a lot more opinions on all of the above. KE2EJ, K2RIW. Go ahead, Eric.
K2RIW, KE2EJ. Well, it really depends upon what frequency you're talking about, what kind of transistors, whether it's FETs, bipolar, or LDMOS. Typically, the stuff that I work on is actually, you know, the input is trip line and it's tuned so that if you were to look at it on a VNA and you look at it from the point of a turn lot, there'll be a specific frequency range in which it will be tuned to, even though it may be broadband, may cover megahertz or hundreds of megahertz. As far as like two broadband tubes, now when we're talking about broadcast transmitters, generally, you know, you're feeding something into the grid and it's in a little grid circuit, but when we start talking about things that are 6 megahertz wide or broadband, it's not the typical tuned circuit that you would think of in say, an FM radio transmitter. So you actually do tune the input. It is the solid state stuff. It's just a matter of how much bandwidth do you want the thing to be able to pass, you know, what frequency range it can pass. And then, of course, with most solid-state amplifiers, you need some kind of a output filter, whereas in broadcast we have these cavities, which are mass filters, which are specifically the width of the transmitter's signal. So in my case, it's 6 megahertz wide. And in order for me to be legal, I have to reduce any energy outside that 6 megahertz within a specific slope. This has got to be a minimum of X number of dB down. So you may think that a solid-state amplifier doesn't have a tune circuit on the input side, but essentially it really does. KQIW, KQJ.
When I was first cutting my teeth in the engineering world at Airborne Instruments Laboratory, the way you measured the input characteristics of, say, an amplifier, is you went and got a signal generator, you went and got a frequency meter, you went and got a directional coupler, a crystal diode detector, and an oscilloscope. In other words, you poured signals into the amplifier at various frequencies, and you looked at how much of the signal reflected back. If, for instance, there was a filter in front of the amplifier, the passband of the filter is a frequency region where very little of the signal reflects back at you. All of the signal flows through into, say, a 50-ohm dummy load. But the way most filters work, with rare exception, they reject certain frequencies. How do they reject those frequencies? The filter has no way of absorbing signals and turning them into heat. There's no dummy load in the average filter. As such, what the filter does is it creates a very high standing wave ratio on the frequencies where it's rejecting. So the way a filter works is the signals that you don't want to pass through the filter, they go up to the filter, up to the front end of the filter, get reflected, and come flying back toward the signal generator. Okay, when you set up this strip line that's doing impedance matching on the input stage of a solid-state amplifier, that base may have an impedance of 3 ohms, and you're starting with a 50-ohm world. So you're using some kind of a strip line impedance matching network, which usually has stubs and various widths and so on. There might be a section of a 13-ohm transmission line alongside of a piece of 50-ohm transmission line, alongside of after a piece of 3-ohm transmission line. There's this complicated network on the input of the amplifier, which is doing impedance matching from the 50-ohm outside world to the 3-ohm world inside of that.
Repeater, timeout.
The 3-ohm world inside of the base of that transistor. Let me drop it. So that impedance matching network, whether you want to or not, is also simultaneously a band pass filter. So in the old days, we had all these separate pieces of equipment that we assembled to make that measurement. Somebody got real smart and decided to put all those pieces of equipment together in one box, and he calls it a vector network analyzer. Inside of that VNA that Eric just mentioned, vector network analyzer, is a signal generator, a frequency, a synthesizer, signal generator, directional couplers, cable going to the outside world, another directional coupler looking at the signal coming back, crystal detector, oscilloscope, a microprocessor computer that takes the data and steps through the frequencies you care about, displays it on the screen as either a polar plot, which you might call a Smith chart, or a XY plot, which is a frequency versus response type response. So a modern day vector network analyzer lets you know right away where that amplifier is tuned just by the way the input circuit behaves. The output circuit, in many cases, there really is a kind of tuning there, but it's not obvious. You don't see the two capacitors and the inductor that look like a pi network. On top of that, because of the crazy impedance ratios you've got with transistors, very rarely do they use a pi network. With tube amplifiers, let me drop this. Impedances you're working with tube-type amplifiers, where the plate impedance might be 1,000 ohms. And so to convert from 1,000 ohms to 50 ohms at a particular frequency region, some very convenient size capacitors, a pair of them, and an inductor, and a pi network does that very nicely. You study the impedances you're working with a transistor, and the frequencies you're working with, that Pi network is no longer correct for you, if you know what I mean. If you try to making a Pi network, you'd need very large picofarads of capacitors, and the L networks they frequently use seem to be much more convenient and much more amenable to that particular circuit. So it takes some experience to know what you're looking at. There is a kind of tuning, but again, what Eric said is it's usually rather broadband, and if you've got to absolutely reject that second harmonic, then an amplifier manufacturer says that's your problem. When you install it into your circuit, you've got to supply that extra filter if you can't tolerate the second harmonic that this amplifier produces. Some of what I think you want to know, Steve, KD2HUC, wait for the beeps, K2IW, the .net.
You know, no matter what kind of amplifier you're using, if you're doing a Class D amplifier, you still need a managed storage device.
Yeah, when it comes to tube circuits, Class C amplification is very popular. When it comes to solid-state circuits, I suspect only a very small percentage of solid-state circuits are run Class C. A few of them are run Class B, but when they're running Class B, they're usually push-pull Class B, a pair of transistors. So Class C transistor circuits, I think, are a bit rare. What do you think, Eric? KE2EJ, K2IW?
Well, if you're in the FM broadcast range, you know, want to keep your cost down. Typically, most of the stuff that I work with is AB. Oh, actually, even the front end of my TV transmitters, and this is AM, it's Class A, before we even get to the drivers. But typically, each amplifier stage is push-pull. That's why the LDMOS transistor cases have two LDMOS, and they're typically designed to run push-pull. But you'll find some, it makes your head scratch. You look at some low-cost FM transmitters, they're Class A, and you need some storage to make up for that time that there's no conduction.
Yeah, the way a Class C amplifier usually works is that current flows through the amplifying device much less than 50% of the time. Sometimes it's only 25% of the time current is flowing, maybe even less than that. And therefore, your transistorized amplifier is producing lots of current for very brief periods of time during the instant of time that the voltage on the collector is low. So therefore, it's creating a short circuit at low voltage, and it's an open circuit at high voltage. Those chunks of energy being issued by the transistor turning on and off almost as a switch has to go into something like a flywheel circuit. That's the tune circuit. In the case of a tube amplifier, it's a Pi network, which has some reasonable amount of Q, like a Q of 10, which means that it's really like a flywheel. Even though you're only giving it pulses, very similar to the push rod on the wheels of a steam engine and the railroad track. That push rod and the piston is only giving you pulses of energy, and the great big wheel acting like a flywheel converts it into a nice circular continuous motion. Well, electronically, you're doing the same thing with the tuned network. The tuned network is taking those pulses and converting them, hopefully, into a rather smooth sine wave with very little deviation. And that deviation, you could see it easily on a spectrum analyzer. When you produce a pure sine wave, there really is only one frequency there. Let me drop. If your sine wave displayed on a voltage-type oscilloscope is anything but a pure sine wave, the signal coming out of your amplifier after its filter network, if it's anything but a pure, smooth sine wave, if there's little glitches anywhere along, if there's crossover distortion near 0 volts, if there's flat topping near the positive peak or the negative peak, if there's any deviation, by the laws of Fourier series and Fourier transform, you are generating other frequencies, which will show up on a spectrum analyzer. So how pure is the sine wave coming out of your amplifier? That's exactly what you're displaying when you look on a spectrum analyzer, which really is saying what frequencies are coming out of the circuit, or what frequencies are coming out of that antenna that's looking at the horizon. That's the kind of information you get out of a spectrum analyzer. A spectrum analyzer is as the world's most broadband receiver with a very broadband tuning characteristic. The good news about a spectrum analyzer is you can look at a lot of frequencies quantitatively. It tells you how much energy there is there at the 470 megs and 540 megs and so on. And it tells you all the frequencies that are present and how strong they are. That's the good news. A barefoot spectrum analyzer, though, is a pretty high noise figure. Not a super sensitive receiver. Let me drop. You can make a spectrum analyzer very frequency flat and very accurate in displaying amplitudes at various frequencies. But if you want to make it sensitive, you've got to put a preamplifier in front of it. A typical spectrum analyzer often has a 30 decibel noise figure. So it's a beautiful broadband receiver, but it's not super sensitive by amateur radio standards. When you're looking at laboratory signals that are being generated 3 feet away with a potent signal generator, that lack of sensitivity is no disadvantage at all. This may be a little bit of the information you're looking for. I think it was Steve. KD2HUC, K2RI, to be good, Steve.
Yeah, hold on a second. This is exactly what I was asking. But as far as the output, why is it that a transistor, I mean, in all the designs that I've seen, all the schematics, they have a low-pass filter for the band. Nothing frequency-specific, just band-specific. Whereas when it comes time, you know, on a tube amp, every time you change frequency, you have to retune. So that's very frequency-specific. And I was wondering what the difference was between the amplifying elements that required that. KD2HUC, back to net.
In some cases, there are ways of building a transistorized amplifier that intentionally you're making it very broadband. The output stage of your power transistor may have an output impedance of 3 ohms. To match that to the 50 ohm world, a broadband transformer-like device could do that. In the case of a tube amplifier, for reasons that are a little bit mysterious to me, we haven't used broadband transformer-like networks to match. And quite often, the tube amplifier is being used in Class C. So you need some real tuning somewhere to give it cue to round out those pulses into nice clean sine waves. A Pi network does that very nicely. The good news about the Pi network is that it can give you a very broad range of impedance matches. You could match to anything from an antenna that acts like 20 ohms to 200 ohms. A well-designed Pi network can match that resistive region and even cancel some of the reactance of the antenna. But in the process of doing that, it is automatically narrowband. And therefore, every time you QSY, you've got to retune your Pi network. For a bunch of reasons that are not quite clear to me right now.
Be an example of a tube that broadband.
I'll go that in a minute, Eric. It seems to be easier to build broadband solid-state amplifiers than broadband tube amplifiers. Broadband tube amplifiers are a bit rare, but in your world, you've worked with them, haven't you, Eric? KE2EJ, K2RIW, go ahead.
Now, if you want to go way, way back, there was a company called Gerald, which became General Instrument, and now it's Motorola. There was a time that they made cable TV amplifiers that were completely made out of tubes and mounted on the poles. And actually, it wasn't all that broadband. It was really two broadband amplifiers that were mixed together. But the plate circuit was rather interesting the way they did it. It's kind of a little bit like the strip line stuff that we're used to seeing nowadays, but a little bit different. It was quite interesting. I don't know the exact output circuit. It's been so many years since I've seen one, but you know, you're talking about several hundred megahertz across one particular tube.
Boy, that to mount that power supply, tube, filament, cooling, up on a pole for a cable TV network, is what I think you're describing. By modern standards, that's a lot of stuff.
Yeah, it had two arms connected to the pole, and a box would stick out from the side of the pole.
That amplifier had what kind of power output capability? And I think you said two amplifiers. Did one of them cover 50 megs to 200, and the other one 200 megs to 1,000 megs, something like that? So what kind of power, what kind of frequency range of the two amplifiers? Over to you, Eric.
Yeah, in those days it was 50 megahertz to I think 600 or 800. They didn't cover the entire UHF band because they used all the in-between frequencies. I think they ended at around 600 or 650, somewhere about there. And it was split where the attenuation of the cable of those days took a dive as you went up higher in frequency. Of course, the loss got incrementally higher. And there was a particular point, which I think was around 150 or 160 megahertz, whereas the first amplifier dealt with 50 to 150, and then the other amplifier dealt with, 150 to 600, and they were AB amplifiers, actually. They weren't Class A, they weren't Class C. So, and some of them were push-pull, even.
Roughly how many watts, Eric? And was there a power tone in there that gave you a change in the tilt as a function of the temperature of the day? Over to you, Eric.
Well, the power tone actually, that lasted, I think that lasted well into the 80s and 90s. Typically today they use a thermistor and the reactive network. Actually, they use a little IC that's a temperature sensor. But in those days, there was an equalizer that actually was part of the combining circuit for the two amplifiers. You're talking about amplifiers that had typically 20 dB, actually some of them had 40 dB of gain, but usually 20 dB of gain with a maximum output of 60 dBmV, not dBm.
So was that 60 dBm microvolts on a 70 ohm line? Is that the way it was done, Eric? dBm meaning microvolts, so 60 dB above a microvolt on a 70 ohm line. Is that approximately what's going on here?
Well, 0 dBmV is 1,000 microvolts, so we're not talking watts here.
Once again, 0 dBmV, did you say is 1 volt? Is that what you just said?
1,000 microvolts. Let me just double check to see if my brain is still right.
1,000 microvolts would be a millivolt. By the way, is a million-to-one ratio, but that's voltage, so we got to divide by 20, so it's a...
Yeah, that's a millivolt.
So you're telling me the amplifier, maximum power output is a millivolt? That sounds kind of low.
No, I was just giving you a frame of reference. 0 dBmV is a millivolt, and the amplifiers had a maximum output of 60 dBmV. But typically the output was run at 40 dBmV. In those days, and in the modern stuff, the typical output of a trunk line amplifier is 20 dBmV.
Yeah, let's try to come up with how many watts that is. I am guessing that the peak envelope power of that amplifier is close to 1 watt if you put all the signal on one frequency. In reality, it's covering all of those signals simultaneously, so it's got to have a lot of headroom so it's not mixing those signals together as intimods. But on one frequency, would you say that the amplifier is capable of a few watts of output, Eric?
Wouldn't that be something like plus 27 dBm?
Yeah, I'm going to see if I can pull up the equation here. So, let's see. 60 dBmV is equivalent to 13.01 dBm. Well, yeah, 60 dBmV is about...
Okay, plus 30, plus 13 dBm is 20 milliwatts. Maybe that's the power on each one of the channels when they're all running simultaneously. I'm having trouble believing the amplifier is only good for 20 milliwatts. Over to you, Eric.
Well, these numbers are based on 50 ohms. And then I've got these numbers here, which is based on 75. So, let's see. Yes. Sixty dBmV is equivalent to here we go, at 75 ohms, 11.25 dBm, which is still a volt, 1,000 millivolts, yeah.
You're talking about numbers in the 10 milliwatt regions. 10 milliwatts is, 10 dBm is 10 milliwatts. That's not very much power. By the way, these tube amplifiers, was that back in the days when you were working with Mr. Ishimura? And I think it was called Huntington Cable TV. Go ahead.
No, when I started working for Ishimura, those things were already past history. There's a company called Secor and Gerald, which is General Instrument, that were making solid-state amplifiers. Actually, those numbers are kind of right, because you would then take that number, you take that 60 and put it into a 30 dB tap, that would then eventually run to the customer's house, which you would eventually bring to the TV set anywhere between 0 and 10 dBmV, so... You don't need big numbers, you just got to overcome the losses of the cable.
So I think you're saying a typical CATV customer gets between 0 and plus 10 dBmV, 0 to 10 dB above a microvolt is what you're presenting to his signal, to his television set. And is that dB microvolt or millivolt? Go ahead.
Well, 0 dBmV is 1,000 microvolts. Yeah, it's millivolts, right?
Once again, 0 dBmV is how many volts on a 75 ohm line, Eric? Go ahead.
It's 1,000 millivolts. No, it's 1,000 microvolts. Thank you. I'm getting confused by these. Right. 1,000 microvolts.
That would make it sound like 1,000 microvolts is a millivolt. And if that's 0 dBm, then the dBmV is millivolts. dB. With reference to millivolts is what dBm seems to be. I thought it was dB microvolts. It looks like it's dBm meaning millivolts. Therefore, 0 is 0 millivolt, 1 millivolt. 0 is the way the log scale works. So 1 millivolt, 1,000 microvolts, dBmV is reference to millivolts. That's what I think we've sort of worked out here.
Yeah, and 60 dBmV is a volt.
Okay. That makes some sense. So, approximately a millivolt to, plus 10 dBmV is probably around 3 millivolts. So, somewhere between 1 and 3 millivolts is the amount of signal you're trying to deliver to that customer's TV set. Sound about right?